and the Scots be so fierce in fighting that often the battle went against our side. And how goes it now? Asked Robin. Is my father alive? Is he well and safe? It goes well now, said John. And here is thy letter. My thanks, John Go in the Wind, said Robin. Then he took the letter to the light to read it. His hand shook, for it was the first word he had had from his father since early winter. The first letter he had ever received, indeed, and it was exciting to know that now he could read it for himself.
Robin, son of John de Burford, from his father. Greeting. It grieves me, my son, more than I can tell you, to know that you are ill. I thank heaven it is not the plague you have had, for that enemy has slain more men than battle, besides the women and children it has taken toll of. It shocked me to learn that you had been left to the care of strangers. Your mother would hardly bear it if I should tell her, but I will not. She is with the Queen, who is in delicate health. I dare not say where, lest this letter fall into unfriendly hands. She supposes that you are far away from London, in Shropshire. It is well. Let her continue to think so, for in truth you soon will be, God willing, and your health permitting, for I have requested the prior to arrange your journey with all speed. You will travel in care of Brother Luke and John Go in the Wind. I had a message from Sir Peter only the day before your letter reached me, asking what had happened to you, for John the Fletcher never returned. Some evil befell him, surely, for he was an honourable servant. Sir Peter was wounded while bringing up forces to my aid, so sorely wounded that he has been taken to a castle nearby, where he will stay until he is able to be taken home. The Scots are being slowly pushed back, and we are gaining ground, since receiving the added help from London and the nearby towns. The king hopes for a peace by the sacrament of Christmas, but the Scots are a stubborn race. I trust that you are improving in health, my son, and in God's grace. So farewell, your father, Sir John de Burford, Thursday after the feast of John the Baptist.
Preparations for Robin's departure began immediately. Brother Luke and Brother Matthew between them devised a sort of chair saddle in which Robin could ride. Part of it was to be made of iron, then it was to be finished with padding and leather at the saddler's. They made another journey into town, taking to Dame Agnes such of Robin's clothing as needed repair. The ironmonger promised to send the framework to the saddler by the following Monday, as early as he was able. The saddler agreed to have his part of the work done by evening of the next day. Dame Agnes put aside her embroidery to do what was required of her, and she too promised that the work would be finished early in the week. Meantime, John Go-in-the-Wind helped Brother Luke lay out a plan of travel. Brother Andrew took Brother Luke's place as cook's helper, and the prior gave orders for certain foods to be put aside for the journey. When all was ready, saddlebags were filled with clothing on one side and food on the other. There were loaves fresh from the oven, a great slab of bacon, cheese, some dried herring, fruits from the garden, and last of all a pasty was set on the top. In it were larks and a rabbit seasoned with herbs and coloured yellow with saffron. The fruits were apples and early pears and plums, which Brother Michael had picked from the trees and vines, kept trained flat along the garden wall.
"'Twill be good for noon quench,' he said, "'when there is no ale to be had, "'and will mind thee to be thankful for God's gifts.'
On the morning they set out, the air was crisp and cool. The sun had not risen above the horizon, but it cast a bright glow into the heavens, promising a fair day. Larks rose from the meadow, straight up as if from pure joy, and they sang, Robin thought, as if it had been the first day of the world. He felt sorry to leave Brother Matthew and all the others who had been so good to him, but it was exciting to start out on the long journey.
"'There are over 100 English miles to go,' said John Go-in-the-Wind, "'and frost is not far off, so we must go steadily.'
He and Brother Luke shared Bayard, the horse, taking turn about, one riding, the other walking beside Robin. They went toward the Oxford Road, then turned westward through Holborn, stopping a moment to pray at each wayside cross, just as if they had been on a pilgrimage.
"'It is indeed a sort of pilgrimage,' said Brother Luke.
for always we shall set forth for the honour of God and in the hope that young Robin will be even stronger at the end of our journey than he is now."
Because it was a market day, the road was crowded with people and animals going toward London. For long no one had been allowed to come into the city because of the plague, but now that the danger was over, people came from everywhere to exchange goods. Some rode in carts piled high with produce, cabbages and bags of grain, cheese, butter and bacon, chickens and ducks. Some drove flocks of goats and sheep, or led pigs or carried faggots of firewood. By noon, the promise of sunshine failed, and the travellers took refuge from a sudden shower under a spreading beech. They were joined by a minstrel, who was glad to share their bread and cheese and pay for his entertainment by singing a lay, which John Goin the Wind picked out on the harp.
"Brother Michael's pears and grapes are a welcome treat to my thirsty throat," said John.
"It seems a week since we broke our fast this morning," said Robin,
eating hungrily.
"We've come a goodly way since early morning," said John, "but we must not linger, or we shall not reach the White Swan by nightfall. I have it from Peter the Hayward that it lies but a good day's journey out of London. It is well to be safe housed after dark, for cutpurses and roisterers do roam the country hereabout. If my father were with us, we should have no fear of anyone," said Robin.
"We shall have faith in the father of us all," said the friar.
It was Brother Luke's turn to ride, so John Goin the Wind walked beside Robin. As he strode along, he began to sing, playing the tune on his harp. The tune was lively and well-measured. Bayard stepped up his pace, the jennet pranced and arched her neck, and Robin wanted to get down and swing along with the others.
"Lend me a hand, John Goin the Wind, and set the crutches so I may walk a while," he directed, interrupting the song.
Brother Luke looked back to see what was delaying them, but nodded as he saw Robin afoot, and John again plucking the strings of the little harp. They hummed as if they had been voices, so that Robin's fingers itched to touch them. He watched John's fingers as they searched out the tune, how they danced on the strings to make the differing chords. He noticed the smooth wood of the harp and how the strings were held with wooden pegs.
He wished he could play on it, and wondered if he could make such an instrument.
Now that noon was past, there were few people on the road, but soon they fell in with a peasant with a shepherd's crook over his shoulder. They asked the way to the next village.
"The village lies just yonder, about an hour's journey," he said. "The road goes through the wood, over the downs, crosses a bridge, then winds up the hill where thou'lt find a butter cross where the market is held. Likely there be naught to buy there, as 'tis past noon. Beyond the cross the road turns more northerly, and there is a fork where it divides. Beyond that I know not how it goes."
"Go you to the village?" asked Robin.
"No, I go to the forest of my lord's manor, where wood for house fires may be gathered. We country folk may have such branches as can be gathered by hook or by crook from the standing trees of the lord's forest."
He left them with a "good day," and crossed the field. Robin grew tired, for he had walked more than a mile. John Goin the Wind helped him into the saddle again, and fastened the crutches on behind. A windmill swung its giant arms in slow obedience to the wind, and a farmer passed them carrying a sack of grain to be ground. Over the treetops the spire of the village church could be seen, and thatched cottages began to appear at the road's edge. They entered the village, where the stone bridge crossed a stream. The butter cross in the centre square stood open to the four winds. The stone paving was still wet from the washing down after market, and the last of the farmers gathered baskets and gear before going home. Brother Luke was ahead, still riding Bayard the horse, but here he stopped and changed places with John Goin the Wind. The road continued to rise beyond the village, winding between hedgerows of hawthorn now starred with rosy fruit. Robin drew his cloak around him, for the air was damp and chilly. About a mile beyond the village, at the top of the hill, they came to the fork in the road. Another cross to the memory of Queen Eleanor stood at the dividing point, but no signpost.
"Now, by May 5th," declared John Goin the Wind, "I know not which road to take."
He drew rein and waited for Brother Luke to come abreast of him.
"Nor do I," said the friar. never having travelled this way."
"Did he not say the right fork?" asked Robin.
"The fellow said not which road leadeth to Oxford," said John. "But I am for the right fork."
"My memory serves me ill," said the friar. "Whether he said one or the other, I know not. Let us say the office here at the cross before we go on. Then we shall go to the right. But it may be that we shall not find the white swan, and shall have to sleep in a hedgerow."
By the time they started on their way again, the wind blew hard, and spits of rain warned them of more to follow. Brother Luke drew his cowl over his head and unfolded a furred robe from the pack to put around Robin. For several miles they plodded on without speaking. The rain held off, but dark clouds scudded low, and the wind was searching. A lonely peasant cottage stood back from the road, but as yet there was no sign of the white swan. Robin grew very tired and wished the day's journey had come to an end.
"Will it be soon, think you?" he asked, not wishing to say how his back ached.
"Whether it be soon or late, I know not," answered the friar. "But these old legs need rest."
Then he shouted to John Go-in-the-Wind, who was some distance ahead.
"What sayest thou, John? How goeth it? Are we near to the inn?"
John shook his head and shouted back, turning Bayard and waiting for the others to come up.
"We must have taken the wrong fork," he said. "I see no inn, and night is nigh. Ahead lies a dark forest, and see, it is raining now. Shall we seek shelter here by the road?
It is an ill thing for young Robin to sleep out in the damp, but if such be our fortune, then we must make the best of it."
"Shall we sleep on the ground?" asked Robin. "What a lark! I have never yet in my life slept out of doors, though it may as well have been out of doors when the east wind blew through the windhole."
"We might go on to the forest and be more sheltered from wind and rain," offered John Go-in-the-Wind. "But that wild beasts do roam about, and highwaymen lurk in the edge of it to leap out at passers-by. I'm for staying here. I have flint and steel to make a fire."
He dismounted and led Bayard to the edge of the road, where he could examine the lay of the land.
Said Brother Luke, "'Tis naught for me to sleep in Mother Nature's arms. Many a night have I been grateful for the comfort of solid ground, and mayhap we can cover young Robin to keep him dry."
He followed John to the field's edge.
"Why, here 'tis, the very thing," he cried, "an ancient tree trunk fallen from age and hollowed with dry rot. It hath stood enough years to make it both wide and deep. We shall not be ill found after all. Come, young master, let me help thee, for I know thou art galled by the saddle, be it ever so soft."
He helped Robin to get down from Jenny's back and adjusted the crutches under his arms.
"It is good that the fullers do shrink and pound this cloth, for it is well nigh rainproof,"
the friar went on as he bustled about, getting the saddlebags down, putting the furred rug inside the great log, and leading Jenny to be tethered to the thicket. John Go-in-the-Wind tied Bayard beside her, leaving them both on a loose rein so they might crop the grass. Robin stood with his back to the wind, holding his cloak about him. This was a real adventure. Even though he might never be a knight in armour and go to battle to defend England, he would know what it was like to make his bed on God's earth, feel the prick of rain in his face, and instead of brocaded bed curtains, see dark clouds making a canopy over him. John cleared a space shielded from the rain on the far side of the log, where the ground was still dry, then set it about with stones, and searched for dry twigs to make his fire. Farther down the sloping meadow he found a ruined ox yoke left by a careless peasant, which would burn long and well. A few dry leaves and some of the punky, rotted wood served as tinder when steel and flint struck a spark in the shelter of the hollow log, and soon there was a cheerful fire which drove back the night and storm. They roasted apples in the fire, but ate the pasty cold, and hunger sourced it better than the finest cook could have done. When Robin woke next morning, John Go-in-the-Wind had a good fire going, even though rain fell at intervals and the wind was still blowing. He was grilling slices of bacon over the fire, and standing beside him was Brother Luke, holding a large loaf from which he was cutting huge slices of bread. He heard Robin stirring and greeted him with his blessing.
"I hope thy log house kept thee dry," he said.
John has been inquiring of the shepherd yonder about the white swan. He says we are beyond it, and it is over on the other road.
I should have remembered, said John, but it is long since I came this way. We truly took the wrong turning.
Let it be a lesson for us, said the good friar. We mind how the two roads were one, where we stopped at the Eleanor Cross, yet so swiftly did the two forks divide that now we are several miles from the one we should have taken.
So it goeth. God grant we may never be worse off than now when we take the wrong turning.
Not far beyond the place where they had camped, a path led through the wood. There they were somewhat sheltered from wind and rain. The shepherd had said to follow the path to a certain stream at the far side of the wood, which would shortly lead them to the high road. They found it without difficulty. John Go in the Wind sang so heartily and made such music with the harp that the way seemed short. When they reached the stream, Brother Luke said,
"'Tis best for thee to go into the water as always. So off with thy clothes, Master Robin."
"But it is cold, and flesh creeps at the thought of it," said Robin, shivering.
"Come, my son, doth thy father stop to say, "'I cannot go into battle for my king because arrows are sharp? Off with thy clothes, I say, else thou'lt lose the strength and skill thou hast begun to have. "'Tis a long way from freezing."
While he spoke, he lifted Robin down and helped him to undress and go into the river. At first Robin's teeth chattered, but in a few moments he was warmer and glad he had made the effort. At noon the little company stopped at the sign of the shepherd's bush for ale to go with their bread and cheese. The host sat himself down beside the friar and asked how things went in London.
"Travellers from London be few since the plague," he said. "Thinkest thou the plague is over?"
"'Tis quiet, at least," answered Brother Luke, "and we believe 'tis gone.
"'And how go the wars? Be they going well? "'Hast heard how 'tis with my lord the king?"
"'It goes hardly, but it goes our way,' said Robin, importantly. "'I have had a letter saying that the king hopes for a peace by the feast of Christmas.'
"'Peace?' said the host, wonderingly. "'Peace is what we all hope for, but we find it seldom, "'for if 'tis not the Welsh, 'tis the Scots.' If 'tis neither one nor the other, then 'tis neighbour against neighbour, or 'tis the lord of the manor against the peasants, begging thy pardon, young master.
They set out again, and made good speed, reaching the village of Heathcote by dusk. There they found an inn at the edge of town, its thatch pulled down over its eyes of windows wherein could be seen a smoky light from the fire. A creaking sign showed the picture of the White Hart.
"An innocent name," said the friar. "But this place hath a fearsome look."
John Go in the Wind held horse and jennet, while the friar went in to inquire about lodging for themselves and their tired beasts. When he came out, he said,
"I have a doubt whether this be a good place to stay. There are ill-seeming ruffians sitting about the fire, and the good wife hath a slatternly look. But we have no choice. Come then."
He helped Robin to the ground and got him in to the fire, for he was cold and stiff from the long day in the saddle. John took the horse and Jennet to the stable, a tumble-down affair at the back. It was fortunate that there was food in the saddlebags, for the White Hart had none to offer. Leather noggins of ale were all that could be had, and when Brother Luke paid for it and for the room, Robin saw the two strangers fasten their look on the money pouch Brother Luke carried for their journey. He wished they could have slept out of doors as they had done the night before, but he was chilled and the fire felt good even though it smoked and made his eyes smart. As soon as they had eaten the bread and cheese, Brother Luke helped Robin up the narrow stair and put him to bed on the straw pallet. Brother Luke fell asleep as soon as he lay down. John was soon snoring too. Robin could hear the wood in the door vibrate with the sound, for John lay just outside the room to guard it. Robin was so tired he felt as if every bone pushed through the straw to find the unyielding boards beneath him. He slept and woke till it seemed as if it should be morning. The two evil-looking men still muttered below over their ale, getting louder as it grew later. At first Robin didn't notice what they were saying. Then something like,
"The minstrel's hefty look,"
caught his ear, so he held his breath to listen, then heard one of them say,
"Come midnight, when 'tis darkest,
I shall take yon minstrel, and thou the friar. Be sure to get the leather bag safe. The child will be nothing, for he cannot move fast, and he will sleep sound. He was like to die of weariness while he ate. Hark! The big one snores like a braying jack.
They were planning to steal the money pouch. What should he do? He must do something and do it quickly. How could he wake the weary friar without noise? Or how warn John Go in the Wind without opening the door? Which should he do first? Perhaps it would be better if he woke the friar first. Softly, softly, Robin slid off the pallet, trying not to rustle the straw. He hitched himself along the floor, but the sound of his moving over the boards alarmed the two who were talking below.
"Hist," said the big one, for Robin knew it was he. "What is that?"
They were still for a moment. So was Robin.
"'Tis naught," answered the other, scornfully. "Thou art easily frightened for so great a bully. 'Tis but a scurrying rat. 'Tis nigh the mid of night," he went on, "for I heard a cock crowing. Shall we start, then?"
"Wait," said the first voice, "because they are city folk, the cock's crow might wake them. So, wait a little."
Robin dared not move, yet there was no time to lose. He reached out his hand, but it fell short of touching the friar's frock by almost a foot. He lifted himself as high as he could on his hands, moved one, bearing his weight, slid both legs after slowly, slowly then moved the other hand, and slid forward again. It did make some sound, but when he listened he heard only the sputter of the fire and a hound's far-off barking. Perhaps the ale had silenced the louts. He touched the friar's shoulder. Brother Luke, used to waking at midnight for matins, sat up immediately, saw the blur of white that was Robin's face, but said nothing, only looked steadily into Robin's eyes until his own grew used to the dark. Robin whispered in his ear.
"Robbers," he said. "Thieves,"
pointing downward. Brother Luke nodded, held his fingers to his lips and rose to his feet without a sound. He crept to the door, keeping close to the wall so as not to tread on a squeaky board. He lifted the latch slowly and opened the door inch by inch, so that John, who lay against it, rolled into the room, still snoring. Brother Luke took firm hold of John's shoulder and at the same time touched his mouth with a finger to warn him not to speak. John was awake in the middle of a snore, but he, too, was used to be wakened suddenly, and was well acquainted with danger, so, knowing that he always snored in his sleep, he began to snore again, nodding his head the while to show that he knew what was afoot. He gave one great snore, sighed heavily, then moaned, as if he had been dreaming and had turned over. He used that time to get soundlessly to his feet. Luckily, he had brought cloaks and other gear in the saddlebags. His own cloak, which was travel-worn and patched, he presently tied by a corner to an iron-bound chest which stood under the window. He motioned for Brother Luke to go down first, showing by gestures how he would hand down the bags, Robin's crutches, and lastly Robin. Then he would follow. It was not far to the ground, for the inn was only a cottage. Would Robin be able to hold his weight by his arms? He could only try. It was a tight squeeze for the friar to go through the small window, but he got through, and by way of the cloak, down to the ground. He grunted when the saddlebags landed against his stomach, but was ready to reach up for the crutches when John leaned out to hand them down. Then came Robin. John pulled the cloak in, and wrapped it partly around him so that he could get out of the window without falling, and held him under the arms until he could get hold of the cloak. Robin was able to let himself down slowly hand over hand to land safely beside the waiting friar. Suddenly, great scuffling and shouting began. John scrambled out of the window and slid to the ground. Then Robin heard the big fellow say,
"By my beard, the birds have flown! The night hag take thee!" shouted the other. "We stay too long over the ale!"
"Run!"
shouted John, catching up the saddlebags, while the friar hoisted Robin to his back, giving him the crutches to hold. They ran, but already the thieves were sliding down the cloak and at their heels. Robin turned, and with one hand thrust the crutches between the big fellow's feet, throwing him to the ground and bringing the other ruffian down on top of him.
"Haste!" urged Robin. "They are so befuddled that each is pounding the other, thinking it is us they have caught."
They got to the stables.
mounted the horses, and were away before the two oafs had untangled themselves. Brother Luke took Robin with him on Bayard, and John Goin the Wind, carrying the saddlebags, rode on Jenny. Not until they were well through the village and out into the open country did they stop to rest and consider what they should do. There, just off the high road, stood a great barn. The door was secured by a padlock, but John Goin the Wind managed to get in through the granary window. He opened one of the smaller doors to the weary travellers, and there they finished the short night. Before leaving in the early morning, the friar said, "We must leave a farthing for our host, whoever he may be, and our blessing." So saying, he said the morning office before they set out again. The next morning the weather cleared, and by the end of the fourth day the spires of Oxford appeared. Before long they crossed the Cherwell into the High Street. Everywhere Robin looked, there were students walking about or talking on street corners. They filled the punts and barges that crowded the two rivers. They sprawled under the park trees, eating bread and cheese. But wherever they were, they talked and talked and talked. Most of the students were poor and were dressed in every sort of party-coloured gown or tunic.
"It seems to me," said Robin, "as if they try to see how outlandish they can make themselves look."
The travellers went up the High, then turned on past the Saxon Tower and the Market Cross to St. John's College, where they were received with courtesy and where they spent the night. Beyond Oxford, the country began to be more rolling. Sometimes the road led through forests, then again it ran beside the river, crossed a bridge, and went up through a village. Once they had to turn aside and allow a cavalcade of horsemen to pass. It swept by in a fine parade of shining mail, bright banners, and gaily caparisoned horses. In their midst rode a lady with her attendants. Robin wished the lady had been his mother. Where was his mother now? Did she know about him and where he was? Did she know that he walked with the help of crutches? They followed the cavalcade up the winding road to the top of the hill, where there was a sign announcing a fair at Wychwood Beck.
"There will be jousting," said Robin. "There will be dancing," said John Goin the Wind.
"And there will be little praying," said Brother Luke. "There will be no room at the inn, so we must not linger long."
"Let us see a little of the fun," begged Robin.
So they turned aside and spent some hours at the fair, tethering the horses near the gate, giving a penny to a lad for watching them. All the country people had come from miles around. They had brought cattle and sheep, dairy butter and cheese, whatever had been their portion after giving what was due to the lord of the manor. Lombards from Europe were there with goods from far-off lands. There were silks and velvets from Italy and France, laces from Flanders. Robin wanted to be everywhere at once. He wanted to watch the tournament, the bear-baiting, the wrestling, and the racing. He wanted to taste all the food, the pigeon pies, the honey tarts, that suckling pig with the apple in its mouth, and the jugged hare. He flitted from one booth to the other with Brother Luke after him. Finally, Brother Luke said,
"Hast seen enough, lad? It is a good way to the next hospice, they tell me, and we have 2 or 3 days' journey ahead of us. So come, my son."
"Let me see only the rest of the Punch and Judy, then," agreed Robin, "and I shall be willing, for never have I seen anything so funny."
"For that only, then," said the friar,
and went to find John, who had been playing tunes and earning a few extra farthings from the dancers. By night of that day they reached an abbey set in a hollow. Its square tower stood above the trees in sign of welcome to the travellers, who were most grateful for the hospitality of the abbot. He told them of the best road to their destination, and of the deep wood through which they would pass. There was frost on the ground when they started out next day. They had been a week on their journey, and according to the abbot's counsel, they had still 2 days or more to go. Great rolling hills began to appear, and over them hung clouds filled with rain. And rain it did before the hour was out. Then, when they had begun to enter the wood that embraced the hill, it slackened, and the sun came out.
"Let us halt here for our midday food," said John,
whose jerkin was wet, because his cloak had been left hanging out the window of the White Hart.
"Here I shall build a fire to warm us and dry our clothes." "Let us hope we are not overtaken by marauding Welsh," said the friar, hopefully, "for we are at the border."
We shall say the office to remind us in whose care we are, here as well as everywhere.
They knelt in the woods as if it had been a cathedral, as indeed it looked to be, for the trees, bare of leaves, arched overhead in the very same way that the groined arches of stone swept up high overhead in the Gothic churches.
Maybe that is where the idea came from, thought Robin.
The fire felt comforting and warm. There was no ale and only one withered apple left, but water flowed in the river hard by from which John filled the leather flagons. After they had eaten, John sang a ballad while he dried his clothes. When Robin asked if he might try the harp, John showed him how to hold it and pluck the strings, but it was not so easy as it appeared. John promised to teach him.
"By all accounts," said Brother Luke, "this forest goeth for miles, and it may well be that we shall not come out of it by nightfall."
"Now I remember this wood," said John, nodding his head, "though it was but once I went through it. It is of great size, but there is a woodman's cottage, I recall, wherein we can shelter for the night. I found the woodman and his good wife, courteous and kindly folk, willing to share what they have." "Let us be on our way," said Robin, "now that we are near to our journey's end. I wish to see my godfather, Sir Peter de Lindsay. Think you he is a good man, as my father says, John Go in the Wind? Will he want me now to stay with him? For how shall I be an esquire, or even a page?"
Robin was thoughtful.
"It is well known in the country round about that he is a gracious master and a noble knight," said John. "His lady, too, is well loved for her goodness to the poor."
"Fear not, my son," the friar assured him.
"Thou'lt find kind friends in thy new home."
All afternoon the way continued through the forest, yet there was no sign of its coming to an end. The dusk began to fall, and the howl of a wolf sent shivers down Robin's spine. Still no woodman's hut appeared, and there was naught but forest trees and brush on every hand. Finally, when it was so dark they could hardly see the path, Robin pointed out a feeble light.
"See, there, through the trees," he said. "A small cottage. That must be the place."
"Ah," John sighed in relief, "then I was not mistaken. It is the woodman's cottage where we shall lodge tonight." "How welcome the hearth and fire will be," declared Brother Luke. "Let us hope we shall be as welcome. By my faith, if we be not welcome, then the serf is an ingrate. For when I passed this way before, I helped yon woodman bind up the wound he'd got from a fallen axe. Then I carried him on my back to the cot, where the woman tended him."
The woodcutter and his wife made them welcome, and shared gladly what they had. The ale was well brewed, and there was pease porridge and bread for supper. Then John played the little harp and sang. The next morning, well refreshed, the three voyagers set out on the last leg of their journey. The weather was neither fair nor rainy, neither hot nor cold, but somewhere in between.
"As English weather is like to be," said the friar.
When true daylight arrived, they had come to the edge of the wood, and now the hills stood all about, being very high toward the north, where the Welsh mountains loomed in the blue distance. For the most part, the road lay low among the hills, winding in and out, following the river. A heavy mist hung over the valley, so thick it was like a white blanket which parted only enough for the next step to be seen, then closed in again. When wayfarers were met, it was as if they had appeared by magic out of nowhere. Once, where the road was narrow, a group of peasants suddenly came out of the mist and stopped to ask their way. Their speech was very strange to Robin, but John Go in the Wind seemed to know what they said, for he directed them in the same strange tongue.
"They are Welsh," he explained, "and have wandered out of their way in the fog. My mother was Welsh, so I know some of the words. There is much trouble with the Welsh along the border here, but these seem like harmless folk."
Late in the afternoon, a breeze suddenly sprang up. In a few moments, the mists lifted and the air cleared. Robin looked up in amazement, for there, rising high against the racing clouds, stood a town with a church tower and castle complete. It must be. It was. Lindsay.
"Look," he cried. "Look, there it is. We have arrived."
"'Tis true," agreed John.
"'It is as I hoped. "'We have arrived before sundown "'and can enter the castle before the gate is closed.'
"'No thanks be to him who guided us aright,' "'said Brother Luke devoutly, blessing himself.
"'Lindsay it is, surely,' said John, "'for only Lindsay stands so, "'on a mound ringed with hills, like a pudding in a saucer. "'We've but to cross yon bridge, go up the hill "'and through the town gate, and we are there. "'From the market cross 'tis but a step to the castle gate. "'It is a happy end to our journey. "'Beyond the town and castle lives my own mother.'
They crossed the bridge and started up the hill. Now that he was so near to his destination, Robin dreaded the meeting with Sir Peter. What sort of welcome would he have, limping as he was on crutches? What sort of page could he be, having no free hands for service? Robin need not have been afraid. As soon as they had passed through the outer gate, a messenger went swiftly ahead of the travellers to announce them. The drawbridge was down and the gate opened to them without question, and they were received in the great hall as if they had been emissaries of the king. Sir Peter was scarcely recovered from his wounds. He sat in a high-backed chair near the fire, while Lady Constance sat at her embroidery frame with a small girl leaning against her knee. Nearby were her ladies and two little boys who romped with the hounds. When the travellers entered the hall, Lady Constance rose and, drawing the children about her, stood beside Sir Peter to greet them.
"'It is a true pleasure to welcome you into our household,' said Sir Peter to Robin, not seeming to notice that Robin could not straighten. "'We are grateful to this good friar for his care of you, and to John Gawain the Wind, who is known to us. This is Lady Constance and our daughter Alison, and these are my two sons, Henry and Richard.'
Lady Constance warmly embraced Robin, crutches and all.
"'We have long awaited your coming, dear child, and now we are most happy that you have safely arrived.' "'I shall make a sorry page, my lady,' said Robin ruefully. "'But I can sing and I can read a little to while away the time for your lordship,' he offered. "'And I can pen letters for you.'
Sir Peter kept Robin's hand in his and spoke directly to him.
"'Each of us has his place in the world,' he said. "'If we cannot serve in one way, there is always another. "'If we do what we are able, a door always opens to something else.'
"'There it was again,' Robin thought. "'A door.'
He wondered whether Sir Peter meant the same thing that Brother Luke had intended. Each of the travellers was assigned to his own place. Robin was to have a chamber in the keep. The friar was to be lodged in a little room over the chapel in the inner ward of the castle, and John Gawain the Wind was given quarters over the outer entrance gate. Before leaving the hall, he asked a favour.
"'By your leave,' he said, "'I would like to visit my old mother, who lives not far away. But I shall stay here a while, until my young master finds his way about.
Now that he was well received, Robin found everything about Lindsay exciting and interesting. The view from the top of the keep where they went in the morning was breathtaking.
"'I can see for miles, in every direction,' he said excitedly. "'Surely no enemy could attack without being seen by the watch.'
"'Didst forget the fog?' asked John Gawain the Wind, who had accompanied him. "'And look yonder,' said Adam the bowman, who stood watch that day. "'See that tiny moving spot in the field?'
At first Robin could not find anything that moved in the open field to which Adam pointed. Then he was just able to make out the figure of a shepherd and a flock of sheep. After a great deal of Adam's directing and pointing, he could see a woodcutter emerging from the trees by the river.
"'By night, or under cover of mist,' said Adam, "'a whole army could creep over hill and through forest without being seen. "'Tis from the north and west that we look for trouble. "'Lord Jocelyn to the west hath long coveted this domain, "'and Sir Hugh Fitzhugh to the north yonder, "'who is cousin to Sir Peter, hath a quarrel with him.
"'But they could not take so strong a castle, surely,' said Robin.
"'We can be starved out,' said Adam.
From the other side of the tower, Robin could look down upon the town and the church roof, and see clearly how the church was shaped like a cross. He could see the roof of the market cross in the open square, and the people walking about. He could see the bend of the river and the two bridges, one leading west and the one to the south, where they had crossed yesterday. To the north, the ground fell straight away down to the river, more than 100 feet below.
"'My mother's cottage is there,' said John, pointing north,
"'over the hill and into the next valley.'
Robin could see where the tower of the village church showed above the trees.
Beyond, he could see the manor house against a dark forest which crowned the hills, far, far away.
"Is it near to the village where yon church tower stands?" asked Robin.
"Aye, 'tis just there this side of the church. A tidy bit of a house on the heath where she lives alone with her cat. There is a pass all the way. If thou art to call upon her, she would bake thee a bannock."
Robin repeated the directions, but laughed at the thought of going all that way to make a visit.
"Go you by that road, I see, leading up from the river here?" he asked again.
"No," said John, "for 'tis a long way round by Leatham Bridge. I go through the town and by the Drover's Road, and across the ford beyond."
It was more difficult for Robin to go down the circular stair from the top of the keep than it had been to go up. Each step was set on a centre newel, and the steps fanned out from it. Robin had to keep to the outside wall to allow room for the crutches to spread far enough to bear his weight. John went ahead of him to catch him in case he should fall.
"I shall get the way of it soon," said Robin.
Before the day was out, he found it easier. They had gone up and down stair after stair, up to the watchtowers and the belfry of the chapel, to the kitchens and storerooms, to the armoury and down to the dungeons. Then John took Robin to the stables to see the horses. There were dappled Percherons from France, and shire geldings of tremendous size built to bear the weight of men in armour. There were lighter animals for hunting, hawking and riding, and others still smaller, like the jennet Robin had ridden. Robin thought the grey one looked like his father's favourite. How he wished he might ride it, going astride properly as he should. Would he ever again be able to mount a horse? Would he be able to practice in the tilting yard, or go a-hawking? Would he ever stand straight and tall? Last of all, they went to the workshop near the stables. There the yew bows were made and repaired. Staves for lances and pike staffs were cut. Such small things as plates, cups, bowls and platters were made by the turners in the town. Arrows were made by the fletchers.
"It is here we shall make the little harp," said John.
"Can we make it soon?" asked Robin.
"We shall begin tomorrow, if I can find the wood," promised John.
As soon as Robin was settled in the household of the castle, he was taken in hand again by Brother Luke, who laid out a plan of study and recreation for him that would fit in with the duties assigned him as page. Sir Peter had explained that he would expect Robin to attend to everything which it was possible for him to do. Part of each day was spent with Adam, the yeoman, shooting at a mark. Part of the day in studying Latin. Evenings after supper, the household servants, pages, craftsmen, and all those not on watch, gathered about the fire in the great hall, where Piers Nightingale or John told tales or sang ballads. Each day the friar took Robin down the long path to the river to swim. The water was cold as ice and swift flowing, but now Robin had learned to grit his teeth and plunge in. It should have been one of his duties to serve at the high table, where Sir Peter and the Lady Constance sat with other members of the family and visiting nobles. But because it was so difficult for him to carry things, he was excused from that, and was required only to see that his lady was well looked after, and the little boys were helped with the cutting of their meat and breaking of the bread for supping. One of the hounds that searched for bones among the straw litter learned to come to Robin for tidbits, seeming to know that he had found a special friend. Robin was careful to find bones from the joint with juicy bits of meat still clinging to them, and soon he was Robin's friend. He even slept by Robin's bed instead of near the fire in the hall with the other dogs, and followed him everywhere. His name was Dath, because he had been brought from a town in Flanders of that name. One day, late in October, as the friar walked with Robin along the side of the hill leading down to the river, Dath following, Robin stopped in the path.
"Think you it is really helping my legs to swim?" he asked anxiously. "I cannot straighten my back, and can walk only as before, halfway bent over. What think you, Brother Luke? Shall I ever straighten?"
"I know not what to think about that."
Brother Luke sighed. Then he lifted his head and said firmly,
"God alone knows whether thou'lt straighten or no. I know not. But this I tell thee, a fine and beautiful life lies before thee, because thou hast a lively mind and a good wit. Thine arms are very strong and sturdy. Swimming has helped to make them so, but only because thou hast had the will to do it. Fret not, my son. None of us is perfect.
It is better to have crooked legs than a crooked spirit. We can only do the best we can with what we have. That, after all, is the measure of success, what we do with what we have. Come, let us go on."
Robin nodded slowly, then said hopefully, "Peter the bowman says I have a good arm for the bow and a keen eye for the mark. I can put an arrow up quite well for a beginner," he says.
"And how goeth the woodworking?" asked the friar.
"John Go in the Wind is helping me to shape the base of the little Saxon harp. It is to be almost like his, but it is to have my own mark. Where the front block holds the thin maple in a curve, his is plain. Mine shall have tracery." He bent the maple around an oval-shaped form whilst it was green. "And meantime, John is showing me how to shape and smooth the post, which is the upright. It, too, is of maple, but it is well seasoned and beautifully marked. From a deer that Adam the bowman killed, we are drying gut for the strings."
"Thou art becoming a true craftsman," said the friar. "And wilt be able to play the harp when 'tis done?"
"Already I can pick out part of the tune of Car the Yours, and can sing it as well. It is sad, but pleasant to hear. When I learn it all, I shall sing it for my Lady Constance. And when I see my mother again, I shall sing it for her."
Robin stopped for a moment, then went on, thoughtfully. "Think you my mother will know me when she sees me thus?"
"Thy mother will know and love thee always, my son," the friar assured him. "Whether thou art bent or straight, well or ill, knight or clerk, lord or minstrel."
When would he see his mother? Where was she now? October had passed in lingering summer warmth, but with the coming of November there was often fog and rain. When it cleared, raw winds swept down from the north, whistling through corridors and hall, sending up whirls of dust in the courtyard, billowing the tapestries that hung on the wall. Brother Luke took Robin each day, as before, to swim. They followed the path to a place near Leatham Bridge.
"It will be good for thee even in the chilly autumn weather," he comforted, when Robin shivered at the thought of the icy water. "It sends the blood flying through thy veins to warm thee. Besides, it strengthens thy body, and, best of all, it strengthens thy spirit to do a hard thing."
Robin was now quite strong, although he could not straighten. He was able to go about easily from keep to tower, from hall to chapel, from turret to dungeon. Even the twisting stairs held no terror for him, because he had learned to place the crutches carefully and swiftly where they would hold and balance him. He could play games with the boys in the courtyard, shooting at a mark, hide-and-go-seek, and duck on a rock. Robin's keen eye and strong arms helped him to send the duck, a small pointed stone, so far he could easily get to the goal and back before the other boys could retrieve the duck.
"Oh, no fair!" cried Dennis one day. "You can go twice as fast as we can on those 7-league boots of yours."
Robin only laughed and played the harder. Many times a day he went in and out the castle gate, and he had already made friends with Alan at gate. Alan was a gruff old fellow, for he was long hours in attendance on duty, and was responsible for the safety of all within the castle. He challenged everyone who passed, whether going in or coming out, demanding to know his business. Robin soon learned that Alan at gate had a soft side, as well as a rough one. Once, when he had come on Alan unawares, he heard him playing the flageolet. Robin told him about the Saxon harp he was making. Robin discovered, too, that Alan liked sweets, so he kept a good supply of honey cakes in his pocket for largesse. He was allowed to come and go through the gate whenever he liked, with Dath at his heels.
"Now that the castle is well known to thee, and thou art well started on making the harp, it is time for me to visit my old mother," said Jongo in the Wind to Robin. "Dost know how to go on with the harp?"
"Yes, I'm sure I do," Robin answered. "It is a secret I wish to keep, and if I need help, Brother Luke can give it me. William Wise, the farrier, is making the tool of hardened iron, as you asked him to do. I shall be careful to make the holes and the pegs for the strings to fit. Let me see once more how they go and how many there are."
John showed Robin the graceful instrument, and how the 7 strings were fastened with tiny pegs in the maple sounding board which covered the hollow oval base. He showed him how they were drawn tightly to the upper arm of the harp by wooden keys, which just fitted the tapered holes tightly enough
so they stayed whichever way they were turned.
"'Twill not be easy to get the keys exactly like the holes," he cautioned.
"No," said Robin, "but I can do it. I know I can."
"Thou canst but try," said John.
"Anyone can not do it."
Robin went with John across the courtyard to the outer gate.
"Dost know where to find me in case of need?" asked John.
"Yes,"
said Robin, mimicking the way John had told it to him. "'Tis over the path, beyond the river, across yon field, and through the forest, then fording the stream, and up another field, through another wood, and 'tis just there, this side of the church in the village of Tripheath, a tidy bit of a house on the heath where she lives with her cat, and if thou art there, she'll bake thee a bannock." John laughed. "That's the right of it," he agreed. "And now, farewell, young master." John slung his pack and the harp across his back, and was gone. Early that same day, mists began to rise, which later became a thick fog. Little could be seen from watchtower or wall, but a blank whiteness covering everything. Even the outer walls of the castle were hidden from the watchman at the top of the keep. When Robin crossed the outer bailey, going from the workshop along the wall to the inner castle gate, he could see only a few steps ahead. Sometimes he could scarcely see Dath, who was close at his heels. Sometimes heads appeared out of nowhere, or legs walked along as if they were unattached. When Robin reached the drawbridge and started to cross, Alan at Gate's voice shouted the challenge. Even though the voice was familiar, it sounded ghost-like and strange to Robin as it came out of the fog.
"Who goes there?" said the voice.
"'Tis I, Robin," came the answer, as Robin crossed the moat and passed under the portcullis.
"This be a treacherous cloud of mist," said Alan at Gate as Robin entered.
"Will there be danger in it, think you?" asked Robin.
"Aye, danger enough," said Alan gravely. "The Welsh yonder long have wanted this castle, for it be strong. Now, with fog to help, and so few to guard the wall,